This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is brought to you by the Expert Institute. Check out Expert Institute's new cutting-edge feature, Expert Radar, where they track down background information about your own expert or the opposing expert, including their litigation activity, any times they've been challenged, speeches, articles, presentations, deposition transcripts, you name it. Just push the button and let them go to work tracking down all that information for you. Saves you time, and when they find information that is helpful to you, it can be a game changer for your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. Today's episode is also brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a digital marketing and web development firm specializing in helping the high end of the trial practice develop great websites, great digital marketing campaigns. Give them a call, talk to Tyler or Micah over there, see what they can do for you. Finally, today's episode is brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used by trial lawyers all over the country to help manage the docket of cases that you have in your practice. Allows you to do everything from templates to forms to work plans, saves time, makes your practice more profitable and efficient. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon.
And I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
Rahul, how's the last couple of weeks treated you?
Everything's been fine here. Weather's been actually fantastic, but I'm headed up to Sacramento on Monday to start a trial. How's everything going for you?
Things are great. We're doing things. Our courts are finally opening up, as I mentioned last time. And our tennis team had its first match the other day. We won. So I'm now a winning tennis coach. So very excited about that.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Another match today, although it's raining at the moment. So that'll probably be canceled. So today we're really excited to welcome Joe and Pat Cullen from the Cullen and Cullen Law firm, which is based out of Omaha, Nebraska, but has offices in Kansas City and Phoenix, Arizona. Welcome to the podcast, guys.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Hey, thanks for having us. This is great.
So Joe and Pat have been on somewhat of a tear recently. They have obtained record-setting verdicts in difficult venues in Omaha and in Kansas City just over the last several months. And that adds to a string of really great record-setting verdicts that they've both had throughout their career. But before we get into those verdicts, can you guys take us back and tell us about your firm a little bit? I know your dad started the practice, and you have the unique characteristic of maybe all or most of the lawyers in your firm, including both of you, are also medical doctors. Can you kind of tell us about that?
Yeah, well, for the two of us, I'd say joining the law firm probably started back when we were about 10 or 11 years old, and probably even earlier. But we would join our father at depositions in the courtroom and at the office. And every day, we would go do our stuff, and then we'd come home. And I remember one of the best parts of the day was when Dad would come home, we'd sit around the dinner table, and he would just tell story after story after story of depositions or what happened in the courtroom. And it was, we'd sit around the table for half hour, 45 minutes, an hour, just listening to his stories. And I can only believe now that I'm older that some of those stories were maybe a little bit embellished, but they truly wanted us. We wanted to become lawyers so bad, just like my dad was a lawyer. And we wanted to become him from a very young age. And I can remember probably maybe sixth or seventh grade talking to my teachers about how the fact that I was going to go to law school and I was going to go to medical school just like my father, and I was going to become a trial lawyer. I mean, how many people are saying they want to be a trial lawyer at such a young age, and not only be a trial lawyer, but go through all the academics and the process of doing law school and medical school. And it's not just my father, but also my uncle, Sam. He's also a physician and an attorney. We certainly look up to him, and he has been a big inspiration in our life too. So very young age, we wanted to join the law firm and be part of it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Cullen and Cullen name, just to kind of fill in a little bit, you know, it started with our father and his brother. And obviously our father had a, you know, kind of a unique position in the legal field, being a physician as well as a lawyer. And he was able to kind of bring those two professions together to really do wonderful things for his clients. And we grew up watching that, seeing that, and actually kind of thinking that was normal. Like Joe said, my thought was, you know, after college, you either go to law school or medical school, and then you go to the other when you're finished with that. You know, it wasn't really anything out of the ordinary to us to kind of do that. And growing up the way we did see the kind of advantage or the necessity to have that kind of knowledge base to be able to do what we wanted to do. So that's kind of Cullen and Cullen started with our...
Did your dad go to medical school intending to use that degree to practice law? Or sometimes I see lawyers who are former doctors who just get disenchanted with the medical profession perhaps and move into law. But was it always intentional like that? It seems like it was with the two of you.
With us, for sure it was. For him, I think he was just one of those individuals who just craves knowledge and probably started medical school for the simple enjoyment of learning medicine. And similarly with the law, he just loved learning, never stopped learning, whether it was formally or informally as he kind of developed in his career. But for us, it was definitely a career track, if you will. Definitely more planned out and thought out that way.
You guys don't look that old. I mean, have you gone through medical, and how many years did all that take?
I think I finally finished schooling at age 33 or 34, somewhere around there. After we're finishing European boards and before coming back to the United States, I think I was 33 years old. But it's the greatest 33 years I've ever had. And I'd go back to school in a second if I could.
What's the best story your dad had about his career, whether true or embellished?
Too many stories to tell. I can remember he was a full-time practicing lawyer when he was going through medical school. And he was doing his training. I remember at one point in time, I think he was representing about half of his professors. And he would sit there at the hospital, and he would come home at the end of the day, and they would sit around the central station in the hospital, and he would be working on their cases, like legal cases for them and their family, as they were supposed to be rounding at the hospital on patients and doing things at the hospital. But he was actually doing legal work for a lot of the people at the hospital, which was kind of funny. But no, there's too many stories to tell. Boy, Pat, what do you think the story about Dad is?
I don't know. The most vivid things for me are not necessarily stories being told to us, although that happened every night, is just at a young age, he encouraged us to go with him on depositions, to sit in on trials. And he was, you know, is always a little bit of a showman. And so when, you know, things were going well in a deposition, he would just write notes back and forth to us on his big legal pad and, you know, hold them out so that everybody could see, kind of either mocking the situation or just kind of celebrating a little home run that he may have picked up testimonial wise.
What type of character traits from your dad do you think you learned and apply in the way you practice law?
Boy, I mean, I think we don't, we try not to take life too seriously, Robbie Booty. And if you're not willing to laugh and laugh about everything, good things and bad, you probably don't want to be around us very often, because we kind of laugh at everything. Even when things go really bad, we find a way to laugh at it. So no matter what story Dad would tell or where we were at, it always came down to a list of four or five things. He would sit down and lecture us on, you know, what happened at school or what's going on at work, or doesn't matter what it is, but it always come down to this list. He would sit us in his chair in his office, and he'd go up to his butcher paper, and he'd write on the board, and he'd write, you know what the most important things in life are, Joe? And he'd go, number one, God. So he'd write God up there, and he'd tell us why God was so important and how we need to be, you know, a spiritual person. And he actually would always encourage us to become a priest. And I'm not sure he ever wanted us to become a priest, really, but I think he was trying to keep us out of trouble and show us the importance of religion and respect. So God was always number one. Number two, family, and take care of your family, and the importance of being a good brother, and the importance of being a good son, especially to mom. And so then he gives the lecture about item number two, which was being a good family member. So it's always God, family. Number three would kind of switch around as to what was important on that day. It could be whatever he was trying to teach us a lesson on. And then number four was always sports, because we always wanted sports to be number one, but he somehow found a way to tell us that sports was really not that important in life. And he would move it down the list. So it's really God, education was always three. So God, family, education, and then sports. And he would talk to us about education for about a half hour. And even when we were in, you know, maybe third grade, fourth grade, we were talking about which colleges we were going to go to. And that was the list. So when you talk about formidable qualities that Dad presented to us or helped us acquire, it was God, family, education, and then sports and laugh. And that kind of has, I guess, led us through life. And at the end of the day, who are we really? We're kind of people that laugh a lot, that are very humble, and or we try to be humble in nature, and we're very honest. And I think, especially when we go into the courtroom, I think people know that they can rely on us and they can trust us, and they can see those qualities come through. And those qualities are all the things that Dad taught us from a very, very young age. But that's what I'd say.
Are you guys, what are your age differences? Are you the same age? Or are you twins?
We're almost Irish twins. So we're a year apart. When we're sandwiched in the middle, there are five of us total. And we had four boys within 5 years born of each other. And Joe and I'm number two, Joe's number three.
So when you guys go to trial, it's sort of you guys kind of have a tag team approach where you're both, are you sort of interchangeable parts, or does one of you tend to do certain tasks like the opening and the other one does the closing, or you examine certain categories of witnesses? How do you do that in the courtroom?
We'll typically divide up openings, the kind of the bigger stuff. And then on our case in chief, we'll have divided up who's taking who. But with respect to cross-examination, to be honest, Joe and I are both prepared to take any particular witness. And it's more often than not, we'll look at each other and just kind of, who has the, you know, the gut feeling that they really want to go, that they really feel ready. And there'll be times where I'm planning to take a cross-examine of a witness, and he, you know, Joe just is just feeling it. And he'll look at me and say, I'm on. And it's him. He's on. And it's worked well for us. It really has.
Do you guys have the same style, or do you tend to have different styles?
I think we're a little bit different. I mean, I think we're very similar, but we're different. And typically, Pat would be more of the hard charging kind of, I'm going to go get you and I'm going to kill you every time he gets up, but not necessarily always. I mean, he has the ability to be very soft and kind, you know, and more of a compassionate cross. I mean, you really have to be able to diversify your cross examinations and what you're going to do. But I'd say in a typical case, he's more of the
bad cop.
Yeah, bad cop. There you go.
Man, I was just trying to figure out which one of you would be the bad cop, because I've only been around you and been having fun and laughing. So right when you described Pat, though, Pat didn't smile or anything. He just had his game face on when you were describing that killer. That was amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny about the courtroom is sometimes you go up and you do an examination. You don't really know what your own mannerisms are sometimes. But inevitably, it comes down to who we are as people, and we examine. Our examinations come from our personalities, and we get up and we ask questions in a manner that we feel is appropriate. And it's not a preconceived, hey, I'm going to go try and kill this guy or do this or that. But it's just our personalities come out, and I think that's just the way our personalities are, and it comes out on cross and direct examination, actually. So.
How much of an advantage do you think it is that you have the medical training? Because, of course, most jurors don't have that kind of medical training. And if you get too deep into the weeds of the medicine, you can start to lose people.
I think it's a huge advantage. Most trials that we go through at the end, when we're talking to the jurors, half of them, at least half of them, are saying, you guys are physicians, aren't you? We knew it. You know, we knew you guys were doctors. And that's pretty impressive, you know, to have them acknowledge that, because we're not allowed to tell them, obviously. But it comes through the direct examinations, and probably most importantly, the cross examinations, that look, we know what we're talking about. This is our backyard we're playing in here. And, you know, I think it's a huge, huge advantage. particularly in the types of cases we're doing.
You've been able to figure out how to communicate the complex medicine in accessible terms that jurors can relate to, obviously.
Well, I got to make it simple so I understand it.
Yeah. We work very hard to make it as simple as we can. And I mean, literally from in a case like we just did, the Kylie Harris case, which we're going to talk about in a bit here. But we boil it down to good oxygen and bad oxygen. And we don't talk about hypoxia or ischemia. We use good, bad, low, high terms that really the jury can understand. But inevitably, after sitting in the courtroom for 3 weeks, listening to placental pathology and neuroradiology, obstetrics, all of these parts of the medical care and all of these parts of a birth injury case, the jury doesn't truly understand the medicine like we would like them to. But what they do understand is body language. And when we're doing direct examination and cross-examination, I think that's where the medicine really comes out, the fact in our knowledge base, because they can tell by the body language in the courtroom, even if they don't understand what we're talking about, they can tell that we know what we're talking about and the witnesses know that we know what we're talking about. So whether or not we're talking about cord blood gases and pH levels, and if it's a pH of 6.9 versus 7.23, or whether or not there's meconium-laden macrophages in the placenta and how long there was hypoxia prior to that placenta, where those meconium-laden macrophages appeared in the placenta, they developed this understanding that Pat and I know what's happening in this case. And I think that's the key to the whole thing. It's body language as much as anything.
So we'll get into the trials in a second, but between the Morassic trial, which I think occurred in November, didn't it? And the Kylie Harris trial, which occurred in March. You guys have been in trial a lot lately together. I mean, we're talking about months, at least more than a month plus in the courtroom and probably having every meal and spending a lot of time together. You guys still getting along okay?
Well, it's a race to see who can be in the gym first in the morning.
So what's your routine when you guys are in trial? Do you have are you able to get a workout in and meal, or are you guys just up under the gun morning to night?
Workouts are a necessity. So we usually, not kidding, we'll meet each other in the gym probably about 4:30 and then get our workout in for the day. And then we go straight into preparing for the day. And then obviously trial goes and as long as it's going to go in the day. And then we regroup at night, kind of spend the evening together. Yeah. Get a dinner. You know, kind of go through the events of the day, where were we strong, where we need to shore up, and then, you know, just move through with it.
Just out of curiosity, in preparing for these trials, is everything worked up? Are you guys ready to go before you even walk in the courtroom and start picking a jury? Or are things in flux and you're preparing that evening and the following morning for whatever witnesses are coming up or something in between?
I'd say completely the latter. We were usually prepared very last minute in a sense, but we focus more on the medicine than on deposition testimony and impeachment type material. So we think we're going to win the case on the facts of the case and what happened medically. And we let go sitting there for 20 hours reading somebody's deposition, trying to say, I'm going to impeach him here. So I think we're very last minute, and not only to the point of, I guess, preparing last minute, but like Pat said, when somebody's on the stand and they're testifying, we'll just switch it up. And if somebody really wants to take that witness, we'll just let them take the witness because of something that's just come to their head or some way they're going to try and cross-examine, I guess, the obstetrician or the neurologist, whatever it might be. But we flip it up, we switch it up. And most importantly, I think we've learned over the years, what we've really learned is take a step back and take a global picture of the case. We used to be really detail oriented and we'd have to know everything and really want to kind of plan it out. And we're just not that way anymore. And I think it benefits everybody, including the jury, because we're not so focused on one little detail here and there in an outline or a checklist that we might want to get through, but we can sit back and paint the case with broad brushstrokes and focus on what the two or three topics that we think is important. And I think what's developed over time is as you become a better trial lawyer, you can feel and you have a sense of what is important in that courtroom. Before the trial started, you'd have no idea that's going to be the important thing in the courtroom. But if you really sit back and you pay attention, you can feel where the momentum is. You can feel the issues that the jury's kind of struggling with, or you need to spend a little bit more time on. And if you're not preparing last minute, and if you're not really thinking about the case, you're going to miss that. So I think we've become very good at that, actually. And we used to focus on every tree in the forest, and now we focus on the forest itself and something like that. Don't you think, Gideon?
We got a lot of trees and forests up here in Maine, so we're very accustomed to that kind of thing.
Were your trials, any of them with masks on, or were you maskless and no social distancing in the venues you were at?
No, we were maskless, so there's no mask. The only difference really was in the Harris case in Kansas City. When we had voir dire, we were limited because of COVID. We were limited to a 1 hour voir dire, and it was in a social hall. So everybody was socially distanced, and everyone was 6 feet apart. And so at some points in time, you know, juror number 50 was about 500 yards away in a social hall, and we're trying to ask questions in a period of about 22 minutes. So the jury selection process was really not a real process at all. It was just kind of a game where, well, we'll give you an hour to try and pick a jury, but it's really not a jury selection at all. Then we'll just go try the trial. So, but it worked out. The only person I'd ever seen pick a jury in an hour was Brian Panish. And it was in the Hilliard case, I think, years ago. And I went up to watch him, and he picked a jury in an hour. And I kind of watched him, and I saw him focus on a certain amount of topics and how he did it. And that's kind of the method I used. So I chose some key terms from the medical part of the case and some key issues in the damages part of the case, and asked the jury about those topics, really just to kind of see if anybody had any experience with cerebral palsy or brain damage or caring for somebody at home. And then we talked about damages in a general sense. And that's really about it. We weren't able to find out much more than that, but it was kind of inoculating those subjects and those topics into the trial and preparing the jury who was, you know, whoever would have been picked, preparing them for kind of what happened and how significant this injury is. And I think the one thing they came away from the voir dire process is that this is one of the biggest cases that was going to be in any courthouse in the state of Missouri, not only this year, but maybe ever. And they all knew that going into the trial. So it was a big case, and they were going to sit on a very, very important case that was going to be very meaningful to a family.
I don't think of Kansas City or Omaha as necessarily being plaintiff-friendly venues. If you have the ability to do so, and I understand you were limited in that case, but what is your approach to voir dire generally? Are you trying to identify and eliminate problem jurors, or doing more what you just described, Joe, of kind of previewing the major issues in your case or combination?
Okay, hands down, the only thing I can say about voir dire, and the only thing I truly believe about voir dire after listening to dozens and dozens of people talk about it at conventions my whole life, the only thing I truly believe is what I've heard Mo Levine has said. And if you can sit down after performing voir dire and the jury doesn't hate you, you've done a good job. Or if the jury likes you when you sit down. And I truly believe that. I mean, we focus on some key topics, and I think the point is to get those topics out there, get a good feel for the jurors' personalities. And I think we're pretty good at that. I think we're, you know, pretty good people, and we have a pretty good judge of character. And so you get a semblance of, is this person going to be fair? Are they really leaning one side or the other, you know, by their eye contact, body language, things like that. But inevitably, I think in every trial we ever have, I'll have one or two jurors that I thought was on our side, or they're the, you know, very pro our case. And then it turns out that they're kind of middle of the road, or they're leading the other direction. So I don't think you can really say, but I do believe, and I've seen it before, where attorneys, specifically defense attorneys, and we almost set them up for this, to be quite honest with you. I think one of the goals of voir dire is to set up the defense attorney to cross boundaries and cross rules in voir dire by saying, so I'll get up and I'll say, one of the first things I say is, you know, we can't talk about the facts of this case at all. We can't talk. We just can't go into it. It's against the law. And inevitably, the defense attorney gets up and starts talking about the facts of the case, trying to inoculate the facts. And you can see the jurors over there going, hey, he's violating the law. And I think there's a couple elements of that, but just get a good judge of character and then sit down and try and read the body language. And that's about it.
Pat, any further thoughts on that?
No, I think the Mullavine quote is true. You like to think you can identify the bad jurors, but the truth is that the guys who come off sounding bad, I think, just want to get off the panel. They've kind of figured the game out, and if they can, you know, show they're not fair, they're gone. And then the guys who are really scary for you, you know, the silent assassins, they're not going to speak up and identify themselves as someone who's never going to come in for you because they want to be on your jury. So you need to be able to read the nonverbals and kind of watch how they, you know, listen to as much as what they're saying is watch what they're doing when they're responding to you, and try and read them as people to see if, you know, you really think they're going to be a fair juror for you.
So why don't we talk about the two recent trials, Vivian Mrazek? I've heard you guys speak about this a little bit. Fascinating case. I understand you represented a little girl who had gone to the hospital following a fall at home. She was there for a period of observation, and then they discharged her home, and she then suffered seizures or something that occurred when she went home and ended up with severe, essentially catastrophic brain damage from that. And there were a lot of really hard facts in that case. But you ended up taking, I think it was a no or low offer case, and getting a $26.1 million verdict in Omaha, Nebraska, which has to be some kind of record, doesn't it?
It is a record. It beat our last record.
So can you tell us about the case and how you, first of all, why did you take that case, given it sounded like there were some really, really difficult facts for you? And then how did you navigate that to that amazing verdict?
Well, first off, this was a beautiful 11-month-old little girl who had everything going for her. She had two fantastic parents. And why did we take the case? You know, these parents were really set up for failure. They were two honest, hardworking individuals who loved their child. And but for really being grossly misled by the healthcare providers, this would never have happened to their daughter. And we listened to them. We believed their side of the story. It was a lot of he said, she said to the pivotal facts of the case. But, you know, stepping back at it and looking at it from 30,000 feet, this never should have happened to this little girl. And she was devastated. So what did happen was something occurred at daycare. It was a neighborhood daycare that they would drop her, Vivian, off at. And something happened. She suffered head trauma of some sort. That was a kind of a red herring issue throughout the trial. What actually happened? Was there child abuse involved? Or was it a simple, as reported, fall off a toy? But regardless, she had clear signs of significant head trauma that evolved throughout the day to the point where she was having subtle seizure activity. And that was seen amongst other symptoms. And they took her to Children's Hospital in Omaha, Nebraska, which is, you know, holds itself out as the most, you know, capable place for caring for children. And actually saw the first physician, who was the emergency physician, did things right, you know, was suspicious that these could be seizures, and admitted the child for overnight observation. And then that's where the kind of the wheels came off the bus, is that the overnight team didn't really do anything to work up this child and had very little and poor communication with the morning team, who came on at 7:30 the following day and almost immediately discharged this child home without any anti-seizure precautions, without any further workup for seizure activity, and let this child go out the door. And within 48 hours, she had evolved into a situation where they call status epilepticus, where she's having seizures that are not stopping. And the, you know, the hypoxic needs within the brain were exceeded, and she suffered an anoxic brain injury and almost died, actually. And all of this could have been and should have been prevented. That night, she was in the hospital getting no care whatsoever. So that's kind of the outline of broad brush of what happened in the case. But it really boiled down to bad medicine. It was just bad medical care.
I recall there was an issue about whether the parents should have brought her back in sooner because the seizure activity started some point then they found, was it phenobarbital in her system or something when she got back to the hospital? So how did you guys deal with those issues?
We kind of just presented them as kind of two topics there. So the first one, the parents were told that these seizure-like activities were normal sequelae of a severe concussion, and that's what they believed. And they walked out the door and were told that this could recur for 2 weeks. And they literally sat at home, and grandma, Vivian's grandmother, was there saying, hey, she's having a seizure. We need to take her to the hospital. And the mother said, no, this is to be expected. This is what happened at the hospital. They told us that this was expected. Now, obviously, you know, the testimony throughout the case in the trial from the defense team was that the doctors had told this family, you need to return immediately if there are seizures. Return immediately if there are seizures. Parents denied adamantly that that was ever told to them. And why, if that really were told to them, why would they not have returned immediately? Because there's no question that, you know, this little girl experienced seizures for two more days. And then with respect to the phenobarbital, that kind of tied into this shadow of non-accidental trauma. The hospital, in essence, accused mom and dad of having subjected this child to significant head injury, amongst other abuses, such as administering drugs like that was found in her system. And again, we took that head on because there was no evidence that these parents had done anything inappropriate. And that, I think, turned out to be a credibility issue the hospital lost. But with respect to whether or not there was malpractice or not, that really didn't have much to do with it. It was just ended up being a credibility issue that the hospital, I think, dug themselves a pretty deep hole, and we let them right into it.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno. Steno is a court reporting service offering court reporting all over the United States. The great feature of Steno, among others, is that they offer the ability to defer payment for court reporting services until the end of your case, which means you can enhance your cash flow as a plaintiff's lawyer since you're not getting paid until the case resolves, allowing you the freedom to take as many depositions as you want and you need in order to prove your case. Check them out at steno.com. We're also sponsored today by Law Pods. Law Pods is a service that helps lawyers create podcasts like the very podcast you're listening to right now. Law Pods is our producer. All of the great content and production quality for the show, which is terrific, is done by Law Pods. If you have an idea for a podcast or just want to run something by them, check them out at lawpods.com. Give them a call and see what they can do to help you.
So just on the theme of keeping it simple, how did you explain to the jury what the night team should have done? And if they did it, this poor child would be perfectly healthy and happy today.
Yeah, so the hospital hung their hat on the fact that the child didn't have any seizure activity overnight. Well, the child was given an anti-seizure medication in the emergency room that had a half-life of 12 hours. You're not expecting a child to have seizures when she's on anti-seizure medication. So if they wanted to do just counting, you know, any one of us knows if you really want to do a reasonable observation period, maybe wait till the drugs are out of the system. You know, and as we went through that with every expert, you could see the jurors just going, duh, you know. So I mean, certain things you can boil down pretty simple. And that was one thing that I think was available for us.
I understand you guys had three experts and the defense in that case had 10 or something like that. How did that play out?
Yeah, they just kept coming them in, bringing them in.
What did they have 10 experts to say?
I think this was probably the most challenging part of the case. And well, along with the tangential evidence, which was, you know, Facebook posts after the family was discharged from the hospital. We could talk a little bit about that. But I mean, the Children's Hospital really, they made a choice that they're going to defend this case and defend this case hard. And they had about five or six treating physicians that were going to testify and did testify as expert witnesses. And they were treaters and they're local in the community. Then they had about five or six, you know, retained expert witnesses from all over the country, you know, from University of Chicago, Ivy Leaguers. One expert was from Japan. And so they really chose to defend the case hard. And at the end of the day, we had one standard of care expert who also testified to causation. And then we had a neuroradiologist to talk about damages, and that was it. So our case could have been in and done in about 2.5 days if we really wanted it to. But one of the, I guess, big decisions that we had made, you know, leading into this trial is we knew we had to extend our case in chief, and we knew we had to try and balance the time that we were going to be presenting evidence in front of the jury. Otherwise, we would have been done in 2 days, and they would have gone for about 10 days if they wanted to, and it would have just been landslide of evidence just by the fact that they had sheer number of witnesses. And so what we did to counter that was we played video depositions from discovery, and then we called several of the nurses just as sheer fact witnesses. Even if they didn't know really anything at all, we would call the nurses in and we'd have them on the stand and we would talk about what happened. Even if it had no substantive value whatsoever, but the jury was very interested in knowing those facts and what had happened. But it looked like we were presenting, you know, a case that the facts that we thought were important. And it just took a lot of time. And then another thing we did was toward the end of almost 2 or 3 days in a row, we would read in evidence. We'd read deposition testimony just because we needed to fill some time. So I would get up in the jury box and I became the witness. And Pat and I would just sit there and he would just read questions and I would just read answers. And sometimes they're important and a lot of times it had nothing to do with anything. But it was the manner and the body language in which we read the questions and the body language and the manner in which I read the answers. And certain things that were not important became important. And you could see the jury. I could see the jury when I was in the witness box. And I would pause before, you know, some of the key answers. And I would look at them and I would take a really long time and I would slowly read the answer. One or two times I even misread the answers, you know, by one or two words, and the defense would get up and they would object. That's not what the answer says. I'm like, okay, well, let's just read it again. So then I read the good answer again, then they got to hear it twice, which is great. So, but that helped us balance the time. And that was a trial tactic that worked well. So
we knew they were going to go for a long time and we were supposed to start on a Tuesday, but for whatever reason, we got moved forward. And our experts, you know, were all out of town experts. So they were already scheduled. And we wanted to get to Friday because we knew they were going to have, you know, basically 10 days of evidence coming in after us. And we didn't want to be, you know, in and out in 2 days. So that's ended up, honestly, it's ended up a lot of it just filling time. So it looked like we presented more evidence than we intended or needed to.
See, that approach wouldn't work for most people. But you guys are so handsome and charismatic that I'm sure that helped.
Oh, Gideon.
And Joe, did you use different voices for the different witnesses or did you?
Pat might be able to speak to that one. I mean, maybe a little bit here and there. So, but yeah, I'll tell you what, Gideon, we had fun doing it, you know, and we really did enjoy the process. And it's actually fun being up in that jury box. You should try it sometime. I mean, just the power of sitting in that box and being able to testify in your own case is great. So, once again, I think I probably, you know, looking back on it, who did the idea even probably come from? Ravi Pudi? I bet it came from Panish. Didn't Panish? I think he has a story of when he got up in the jury box and he testified in his own case.
Oh, he loved it.
So that's probably where it came from. I can't remember what case that was, but it is fun. Yeah, we had a good time.
It was either Panish or Mo Levine or Paul Levera.
Somebody.
No, Boyle direct examined Panish in his trial.
So yeah, I got a good Paul Levera story for you. Talk about somebody that just controls the courtroom. So another thing my dad did when we were young, we weren't even lawyers yet, but my dad, he flew us out. I flew out to New York, saw Tom Moore in trial, you know, before I was even a lawyer. He's like, oh, Tom Moore's in trial. You got to go see this guy. So I flew to New York, saw Tom Moore. One of the times we went to Seattle, we saw Paul Levera. Paul Levera was in trial and he was probably a month into trial, and it was this huge case. Can't remember the name of the case, but they got a $50+ million verdict. And it's the last day of the trial, I think, wasn't it, Pat? It was the last day of the trial, and Pat and I walk in, and we're just sitting in the back of the courtroom. And I think we had met Paul Levera maybe one time, and I was surprised he even knew who we were. But we sat in the back of the courtroom, and Joel Cunningham's doing the cross examination of the CEO of the company. Of the defendant, Fortune 500 company. Paul Oliveira stops. We walk in and we sit down in the back. He sees us. He stops the trial. He says, Your Honor, we need to take a break here a minute, as Joel Cunningham's doing a cross-examination of the CEO. And he says, and the judge is like, well, what do you mean? Why do we have to take a break? And he goes, we've got the Cullen brothers in here. They've flown in from Nebraska to see part of this trial, and I wanted to introduce them. I want to make sure the jury knows who they are. So the entire courtroom turns around and looks at the two of us, these two little kids in the back of the courtroom. And Paul Oliveira makes us stand up. He introduces us to the jury, to the court, to the judge. And the judge is like, wow, okay, that's great. We have somebody in from Nebraska to watch the trial. And then everyone sits down and we just go on our way. But only Paul Oliveira could get away with something like that.
That's a great story.
He had such command of the courtroom. It was unbelievable.
So do you guys want to tell us about Kylie Harris? This is a case you tried to verdict in Kansas City in March of just this year, and got another record-setting verdict in Kansas City. And so I understand it involved a birth injury to a little girl. Want to tell us about that trial?
Yeah. So this was a case, is another zero offer case, and another case that that we were told we were never going to win. And so went down, we just had a good time. We got a good plan. And the case really involved two things. One, the misuse of Pitocin. And Pitocin is a drug that's used during labor and delivery to augment or stimulate uterine contractions. And it's a very dangerous drug. It's been listed as a high alert medication, whereby if it's misused, it's known to cause serious damage and harm to the baby. And that's exactly what happened. So the case involved Pitocin. And the second thing that it really involved was a physician, an attending physician at a teaching institution that failed to keep an eye on the resident and allowed a first-year resident family practice physician to run the Pitocin and to keep the Pitocin at levels that were dangerous. And what happened was they kept increasing, the nurses and the resident physician kept increasing the levels of Pitocin or the administration, the dosage of Pitocin, which would further increase the frequency and the intensity of the uterine contractions. And that happened throughout the day. And when that happens, there's decreased oxygen and blood supply to the baby's brain. And there was hours and hours and hours of what's called excessive uterine activity, which led to low oxygen and which led to this brain injury to Kylie Harris. So it was really a classic case of misuse of Pitocin and a physician that failed to keep an eye on the resident and the nurses. And what happened, the hospital had settled out prior to trial, and the sole case really at the time of the trial was against the physician. And the defense, well, there's some serious causation defenses they put forth. But standard of care-wise, I mean, I guess her defense was that the hospital was in charge, the nurses titrate the Pitocin, it was their responsibilities, and I was only in there for about the last 20 minutes of the delivery. Why are you hanging this on me? And we had the empty chair there with the hospital, which was very difficult, obviously. But at the end of the day, the jury found that she was 100% liable, and she was the attending physician. She was the one responsible and failed in those responsibilities. So, no. But Kylie, a beautiful little girl, has serious cognitive and communication issues now. And as far as damages go, one of the key pieces of evidence was she's now 4 years old and she's been provided a device to help her communicate where she can push a button and it can say, hi, my name is Kylie Harris. And she communicates by pushing buttons. I would like this piece of food. I need to go to the bathroom and things like that. So, but beautiful little girl.
Can I ask about in your write-up about this, I saw that one of the defenses were that the fetal monitoring strip was normal and that after delivery, the baby's pH or cord pH was normal. How did you guys deal with those issues? I know we're getting into the weeds now of birth injury for some of our listeners, but for those who do this for a living, like me, that kind of interested me and was curious about that. You talk about that.
Yeah, so I guess two things. The fetal monitor strip, really, for those that do a lot of birth injury cases, the strips were not the worst strips that you would ever see. There was a fetal tachycardia at the end of the case, and they had charted moderate variability. But as far as with regard to the uterine activity, there wasn't the classic forms of tachysystole. So tachysystole is a method that nurses and doctors use to see if there's too much Pitocin being administered. And that really wasn't prevalent throughout the course of the labor, but there's different methods. Pat and I were able to talk about what excessive uterine activity is, and there's different methods whereby Pitocin can cause this danger. It's not just tachysystole. And so we focused a lot on these other methods where they can assess and characterize excessive uterine activity. And that's where there's not enough rest between contractions and the contractions are too long. They're called tetanic contractions. There's coupling or tripling. So we focused on those other quantifications and not just tachysystole, but which is difficult because the ACOG and the American Association of Family Practice and really all the governing bodies in obstetrics focuses solely on tachysystole anymore. And they were going to win that battle. So we kind of gave it to them and we focused on our own thing. And then with regard to the pH was normal. The pH was 7.35, I believe, but what happened was over time. So Kylie was born and just really went off for a period of observation because the vacuum was used. And her Apgars were really okay. They weren't terrible. The pH was normal. But what happened was over time, they did a secondary pH, and that pH showed evidence of what's called a metabolic acidosis with a base deficit of minus 12. So what we're able to point out to the jury is once blood flow is restored to the baby, because there's such poor blood flow during the labor and the delivery from the lack of oxygen, after the delivery and the resuscitation, and there's good blood flow established, then the tissues where this acid resides as a result of the hypoxia during the labor, that acid washes out. And that acid washed out into the bloodstream, and we had evidence of that acid at about 12 hours of life. So we gave them what they wanted, and we focused on the areas that we wanted to focus on, and we didn't get in the weeds about whether or not 7.35 pH at the exact time of delivery meant much of anything. We just focused on the fact that there was a metabolic acidosis 12 hours later, and therefore, we know the child had suffered from lack of oxygen at some point in time. And then we tried to polarize that issue because we'd say, well, are you blaming the neonatologist? Did the neonatologist and the NICU screw up? I mean, where'd the acidosis come from? Are they the ones that allowed this to happen? And then, of course, they didn't have an answer for that. And I think that I don't really remember really how else we dealt with that. Do you remember anything else, Pat?
It was an inconsistency from their standpoint that they're saying, look, this child was born with a normal pH, but an hour later is clearly documented to have a pretty significant metabolic acidosis. Where does that come from? And that's where we did go into the weeds a little bit on that, because physiologically, to accept that first cord pH value as they were trying to put it forward was an impossibility. It's just impossible. You can't have a base deficit an hour later of minus 12 if the child truly was, normal pH at the time of birth. And so the only way to explain that is to go into the physiology and show you can have this washout effect. You know, the lactic acid is there, it's just sitting intercellularly. And then it should reperfuse the tissue, it comes out. You know, is that an issue the jury understood? I think the jury, you're looking back at it and, how was it effectively managed at trial? I think the jury figured out pretty quick that something really bad happened to this child, and it wasn't post-birth, So the only time it could have happened is when we were telling them it could have happened.
Sounded like you guys had some pretty effective crosses of their experts. They had an obstetrician, Harvard-educated, and a University of Chicago neonatologist, so they had some heavy hitters there. How did you guys deal with that?
Joe's cross of the obstetrician was one of the best I'd ever seen.
Can you recreate it for us?
I don't think he was 2 minutes in and the guy had lost all self-control and was screaming at my brother. That was, and then to be honest, I stopped. I just tuned out and started laughing. So do you want to tell how you did it? It was pretty awesome. The guy, he testified 25 times in court the year prior. So you would think this guy would know how to handle himself on the stand. But my brother had him unwound literally in about 2 minutes.
Can you give us the first 2 minutes, Joe, of your cross?
I don't remember exactly. I think the reality is he's a very good witness, and he's been around, and he's destroyed a lot of really meritorious cases. And he's, you know, he comes in as an Ivy Leaguer, and he's the author of the self-proclaimed author of one of the, you know, the most important obstetrical textbooks in the country, in Williams Obstetrics. So he's a big name, and he's a big person in the obstetrical field. And to be quite honest, it was kind of scary. We had a really nice, clean case we put on for a week and a half. And then he came in, and I mean, you've all been there before. He's up there for 3 hours, and you can see our juries, the jurors who we thought we really, really had, you could see the doubt start coming into their mind, and you could see the complexion of that case changing. You could feel the momentum was gone, and you could feel the courtroom, the question mark in the courtroom as to what happened in this case. So, you know, oh shit, I thought I really knew. And now this guy, this author of this textbook has come in, and I'm not so sure anymore. And you could really feel that. And we took a break and we walked out, and a great guy, Ryan Terrell, we're trying the case with him, and he was down there in Kansas City, and he comes up and he goes, actually, when the witness is on the stand, he says, man, he's pretty good. You might want to just ask like one or two questions. And I just look at him, I go, I can't do that. The jury will think we're afraid of him. Absolutely not. And so I sat there. I'm like, what am I going to talk to this guy about? You know? So the first thing I did is I just went up and I went trying to buy time in order to decide what I wanted to get into and what issues I wanted to get into. I just started talking about his money and his testimonial history. And I did it in a very slow, methodical manner. And I was very calm. And I started writing. I got the butcher paper out, and I started back in the year 2012. I said, how many times did you testify in 2012? And he said, whatever. And I said, what did you make? $250,000 that year? He goes, yeah, probably. So I wrote down $250,000. And I said, then I just went to 2013 and 2014 and 2015. And I just kept writing down $250,000 on the board as a, you know, and all of a sudden the numbers were starting to get pretty big, and he was becoming really, really uncomfortable. And then I was just going to keep going. I went all the way down to 2002 or 2022. And so all of a sudden we're at, and he testified that was 20% of his income. So therefore he had, in those 10 years, he made 2.25 million. If that's 20% of his income, all of a sudden he's up to what, $20 million. He's been doing it since 1994. So as slowly as this went on, about 5 minutes into it, he goes, look, Mr. Cullen, this isn't about the money. I don't do this for the money. I'm like, well, you say you don't do it for the money. Let's talk about it. But we all know why you're here. And it just went straight down this path of destruction for him. And he's yelling at me. And he said, I don't do it for the money. I'm like, and then, I mean, it just.
There was one point where he interrupts my brother. And he goes, what are we doing here? What are we doing here? And Joe said, well, you've testified 25 times in the last year. You're in the courtroom more than I. You know what's going on here. I ask you questions and you give me answers. And he just lost it again. It was a guy who sat there for 3 hours looking just cool, calm, and collected, just totally came unraveled. And then when Joe moved into the medicine, the guy had lost all confidence and just was just a beaten dog. I mean, that was our best day of trial.
Yeah. So then I got into that. Then we went into the medicine, and I focused on the three or four issues that we were strong on that they were weak on, and came out that he didn't review parts of the neonatal chart. And that was a big deal because in the portions of the neonatal chart, the treating physicians had statements that showed this injury was consistent with an injury that happened during labor and delivery. And I said, well, I basically said that he did that intentionally, and he intentionally didn't review the neonatal chart, because if he had reviewed the neonatal chart, then I'd get asked questions about that. And he didn't want me to be asking questions about that. So here he is coming in, he's reviewed limited parts of the chart, not the full thing. He doesn't have the full picture, yet he's trying to tell a jury what happened, and he's disagreeing with the treating physicians. So then he starts asking me questions on the stand, trying to take control. He's like, well, Mr. Cullen, he takes his facts. He's like, Mr. Cullen, why don't you tell me about this and the pH? How can the pH be normal at 7.35? I said, you know what? You want to ask the questions? Why don't I get up in the jury box and I'll do the testifying, and then you can come down here and you ask the questions, because you're pretty much a lawyer yourself. And then, of course, the judge wasn't going to allow that. But I was ready to get into the jury box, do the testifying, and he could come down and he could ask the questions because he wanted to be the lawyer. And I told the jury that I would give the jury, I'd give them straight answers and tell them exactly what happened because I had reviewed the neonatal chart and he hadn't. So it was kind of funny. It was comical.
That's awesome.
And what about the guy from or gal from University of Chicago, the neonatologist? Pat, you handled that one, right?
Oh, yeah. He was just another guy who came in. This had followed. This was in the afternoon of Joe's cross-examination in the morning. And so they had lost a lot of credibility on their side. And this guy came in too. And I think his arrogance just knew no bounds. And so we just kept kind of reinforcing everybody in the world who disagreed with him. And he came across just incredibly arrogant. Did you think, Joe? I don't think he played well at all.
Yeah, he was very arrogant. And he basically, any parts of the chart that was bad for the defense, he had an explanation for that. And he basically said the treating physicians didn't know what they were doing, or he implied that. And the 12 people from Kansas City didn't like that because they obviously had a tremendous amount of respect for, you know, Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City and the physicians that work there. So they didn't like him. And then when Pat was cross-examining him, I mean, Pat just kept giving him the rope and he just kept tying it around his neck and he really hung himself. And Pat's like, yeah, you're the only person that can know this, right? You're the only physician in the country that can know this kind of stuff. And he's like, yeah, pretty much I am. And he was talking about liver values and liver enzymes and what the liver enzymes should have been had it been an injury in labor and delivery, and what the kidney enzymes should have been if the injury actually happened during labor and delivery. And Pat polarized very well how this guy, he was the greatest physician in the world, and the physicians at Children's Mercy Hospital were just idiots because they don't know about these enzymes and how to time when the injury actually occurred and things like that. So did a very nice job there. So that was a great day.
Here's one thing about prepping. He gave a theory on direct on his own spin on the timing of nucleated red blood cells. And I knew it was just total, you know, BS from just general medical knowledge. And so literally, I spent about 5 minutes just jumping into PubMed, looking up articles that disagreed with him. And so when I got up to cross-examine it, at some point I went through, you know, I can't remember what the specific timing rule he had. I said, do you have any source for that? He goes, no, I just know it because of my background experience with genetics. So then I went through the 5 or 6 studies I just pulled up literally in the last 20 minutes on PubMed and just, you know, well, this one, according to the abstract, says this, or this one says, none of these agree with you. And he was like, oh, well, those are old studies. When I think one was literally a month old. It didn't come off well for him.
Yeah.
So probably the most important thing about that trial, as I understand it, is that you managed to run up, according to Joe, what may have been the largest 3-week bar tab in the history of the hotel where you were staying. Is that really true?
Can neither confirm or deny.
We had a nightly roundtable. So really our schedule throughout the day is we're up at 3:34 in the morning working out, and then we get the workout done. We get our work done between 5 and 7 o'clock in the morning or 5 and 7:30 in the morning to really prepare for the day after, you know, cycling 30 miles or so. And then, you know, after that court day is over, 4:30, 5 p.m., we're tired. And we go to the Capitol Grill, which is right across the street from our hotel. And we were on a steak and salad diet for the course of the 3 weeks, right? So we became well acquainted with the staff there, and they were great. And they would ask us how the trial was going on a daily basis, and we'd give them updates. And we kind of focus group with them, actually. So there's a bartender there named Noah. He's like our good friend now. And they're enthralled with the case, though, and they all want to know about it and what happened and what the witnesses said that day. So we had a good time.
And what was the result of that trial? I don't have it written down here.
I think it was 25 million or 25 million 500,000 or something like that. But the on the damages side, you know, so in Missouri, there's a cap on non-economic damages of 800,000. So our life care plan and the economic damages in this case was 20 million 600 something, or I don't know, somewhere around there. And during closing argument, we talked about all the elements of non-economic damages that they could get. And obviously everybody knew there's significant non-economic damages over the next, for the next 72 years. But I remember I said to them, you know, just respect each other's decisions on that, but we don't really care about that. What we really, really care about is you take care of this girl. And the way you take care of this girl is by giving the economic damages and what was in the economic report of $20,600,000. And we kind of let go the non-economics because we knew we'd never collect it. And we really focused on the economics. And the jury gave 100% of that economic report. And funny enough, actually, they went into jury deliberations. And there was a question 15 minutes into the jury deliberations. And the first question was, can we have the economic report? And the second question, they said, the judge said no. And then they had a second question 5 minutes later, can we have a calculator? And which was always a good sign. So
that's amazing. What was the defense economic report or analysis?
They did not have, they didn't present any economic damages. They didn't, they fought it on liability and causation. And that was really it. Then they just rested on the cross-examination of our life care planner and our economist. So they thought they're going to get a donut, a zero verdict.
Wait, so they knew your client was injured though, right? And had residual issues?
Yeah, so our initial life care plan had a wheelchair. She wasn't walking initially.
Yeah.
So it factored in that kind of that she wouldn't be mobile. But in the 4 years it took to get to trial, she became mobile and she was able to move. And so there was a revision in the life care plan. So they hit that hard trying to say, oh, this life care plan is just speculative. She's come so far. You know, why do we think that'll stop now? You know, they're just trying to give you services for which she may never, ever need. So they took a shot at that, but they didn't put their own
amazing
forward.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, guys, congrats on your verdicts and continued success. And thanks so much for joining us for this podcast. We really appreciate it. Learned a lot. Enjoyed it.
Hey, thanks for having us. It was a great time.
It's great seeing you both.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.